This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Happy Valentine's Day to you. Well, we had a huge response from you to Jonathan and Abby, our Subway Missed Connections couple from yesterday's show. So romantic. And you've given us lots of stories about the ones that got away. In the spirit of the holiday, we're going to try our hand at playing Cupid and see if we can help you find that one that might have gotten away. Later, we'll hear why Kansas is moving forward with a bill allowing businesses and individuals to deny services for gay couples getting married. A Republican lawmaker who voted against that bill will be with us, and a constitutional expert to tell us where it all might be headed. And what does it take to make a relationship last? One couple who's been together for more than 35 years shares their story with us. But first, if you're anything like me on this Valentine's Day, you might be spending your night with a good movie, a cat, a bottle of something, and that's it. Just the four of us. And if you're prone to a drink, or if you're not, you'll want to pay attention to this next story, though. It concerns a big push around the country to make it easier to buy that booze. At least half a dozen states are looking to change their laws around alcohol this year. And much of what remains on the statute books dates back to the Prohibition era, which finally came to a close with the ratification of the 21st Amendment in December of 1933. Listen.
The decisive vote of the 36th state against Prohibition is happy news for the grain raisers of the United States and for many others throughout the land. With an eye on December 5th, work is being rushed in distilleries and bottling works. Thousands are being called back to work in plants of allied industries. At least 500,000 new jobs are predicted as the result of repeal.
That's a good thing we don't still do news like that. FDR may have ended Prohibition, but today in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, there are only about 600 stores across the whole state where you can buy liquor. All of them are run by the state. If voters pass a new proposal there, that could change. In Minnesota, meanwhile, there's a proposal to end that state's ban against selling liquor on Sundays. Oregon is thinking about allowing liquor sales in grocery stores. In Tennessee, they might allow wine sales in grocery stores. And in Connecticut, they're considering dropping the excise tax on all alcohol. Those are just a few examples. Well, Elaine Povich is staff writer for Stateline, a news service from the Pew Charitable Trust. And she's been reporting on all of these proposed changes, what they might mean for state economies and for their citizens' health. Elaine, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Happy to be here.
Good to have you. The real question is why now and why in so many states? Is it just a question of tight budgets and states get taxes and they want to sell more booze? Is it that simple?
Part of it is that way, I think. But I think also part of it is that some states that have these antiquated laws are really sort of tired of them. And part of it is financial. They're tired of losing sales to other states. Pennsylvania, for example, sees a lot of its liquor sales being bought across the border in places like, say, New Jersey. And they're seeing that they're losing their revenue that way. And it's also a matter of convenience. Voters have said in poll after poll after poll, make this easier for us. Did you know that the biggest retail shopping day of any in the country is Saturday? The second biggest shopping day is, no surprise, Sunday.
Sure.
And in the states where you can't buy alcohol on Sundays, it's kind of a pain in the neck. Here you are out on Sunday doing all your shopping for your weekly groceries and, you know, everything you're laying in for the week and maybe something to watch the football game with later that day. Oh, shoot, forgot to buy the beer. I can't do, you know, and it's just, so when you poll the voters, they say, come on, people, this is not prohibition. It's not going to make a difference in how much I buy. It's simply going to make a difference when and where I buy it.
Still, at the same time, when you see so many states acting in a similar way all at once, you've covered politics long enough, you start to smell a coordinated lobbying campaign from industry.
Well, there is. And there's a lobbying campaign among the liquor industry in particular, and they are very, very organized and very powerful. But look, you take a state like Pennsylvania, and privatizing the liquor stores is – the liquor industry hasn't really taken a public position on that one. But I'll tell you who's taken a public position on the other side, and that's the unions. The United Food and Commercial Workers is absolutely opposed to closing the state stores. They believe that their workers in state liquor stores will lose their jobs and that there won't be enough pickup in the jobs in the retail stores to make up for it.
Because those are state workers.
Sure. And they say, for example, you know, if you're working in a state liquor store, good job, good benefits. Okay, let's say they close and all the wine sales go to Walmart.
Right.
Walmart is going to make room for the wine, and they're going to rearrange their shelves, and they're going to rearrange their current workforce.
Right. Well,
they're not picking up those hires.
Well, Pennsylvania is just one of the states where they're reconsidering liquor, beer, and wine laws. Tennessee, Oregon, Connecticut, of course, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, and others. That's Elaine Povich, staff writer for Stateline, a news service from the Pew Charitable Trust. Elaine, thanks so much.
Happy to be here.
Well, in just a few minutes, our How Do They Do That guide takes a look at the physics behind the always kinetic world of Olympic ice skating. But on this day dedicated to those cheesy cards and teddy bears and expensive dinners, here's something about the science that lies at the core of Valentine's Day. It's the biology of love. And as a single guy, I kind of like this. Let's get reductionist here. Forget about your heart. The thrill of a new relationship and the disappointment you might feel after a breakup, it all has to do with the brain. So says anthropologist Helen Fisher. She's author of The Anatomy of Love and Why We Love and is professor at Rutgers University. Professor, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and happy to have you here. You know, I took a course way back when on the neuroscience of love, and the professor was a neuroscientist, but on day one, he stood at the head of the class and said, "Don't try to reduce the experience of love to chemicals." And then he turned around and did it.
Well, for me, it's expanded it. I mean, the more you know about love, the more you see the magic in the love. So I've always been fascinated with it. You know, people used to feel that romantic love was part of the supernatural. They didn't look at it at all. They don't think that anger is part of the supernatural or fear, but they really relegated romantic love to the supernatural. But we're getting to know more and more about it. And as we do, in fact, it's an addiction, a very positive addiction when things are going well, and a really negative addiction when things are going poorly. You know, I and my colleagues have now put over 100 people into a brain scanner and studied the brain circuitry of romantic love, that feeling of intense elation, giddiness, euphoria, obsessive thinking, craving for the person, high motivation to win them. And in fact, what we've learned from the brain scanning is that when you're madly in love with somebody, there's a lot of activity in a tiny little factory near the base of the brain called the ventral tegmental area, and it begins to pump out dopamine. And it's the dopamine that gives you that energy, the elation, the focus, the motivation, and the feeling that this person is really special.
It sounds a bit sexy the way you describe it. It might not be intended, but
it can trigger the sex drive. I mean, as you drive up the dopamine system in the brain, it triggers the testosterone system, and suddenly you feel the sex drive for the person too. You know, 3 weeks ago, he was just a nice guy in the gym or a great girl in your social circle, but then when you begin to fall in love with them, they become very sexy too. So those two brain systems often go together.
Well,
not always. But, you know, you can have sex with somebody you're not in love with, and you can be in love with somebody you've never had sex with. But the bottom line is they often trigger each other.
Well, that's great. But what does the ventral segmental area teach us, teach us about making it last? It makes a lot of sense in terms of getting there and getting turned on and attached to somebody you know, thinking they're the greatest. What does it teach us about making it last, keeping that dopamine going?
Well, you know, our first group of people we put into the brain scanner had just fallen happily in love. The second were people who had just been rejected in love. And the third group of people were people in their 50s and 60s who were married an average of 21 years. And they told us that they were still madly in love with their partners. So we put them in the machine. The first author was Bianca Acevedo. We found the same activity in the ventral tegmental area. They were still pumping out that dopamine. There were some differences, though. Among those people who had just fallen happily in love, there's a lot of anxiety when you've just fallen happily in love, and we found that in the brain. But when you're in love long term, that anxiety is now dissipated, and instead we find activity in brain regions linked with calm. And you know, what's really interesting to me is I do this annual study called Singles in America with Match.com, and we poll not the Match population, but the American population. And last year, we polled not only 5,000 singles, but 1,000 married people. And we asked these people, almost all of them married between 10 and 20 years, would you remarry the same person that you're married to now? And 81% said yes. Hmm. And 75% said that were still in love, not just loving, but in love with that partner. So it is possible. And in fact, we've even found some of the brain circuitry for happiness.
Before we let you go, Ellen Fisher, you know, the great Christopher Hitchens wrote in his memoir that he thought the most admirable quality in a woman was the ability to think like a man, and that the most admirable quality in a man was the ability to think like a woman. What do you think about that?
I think that's wonderful. You know, we're all part male and all female. You know, there's many chemical systems in the brain. We all have a good deal of testosterone and a good deal of estrogen, but we vary. I mean, in fact, I've never met two people who are alike. But we do know now that you can sustain a long-term happy marriage. We know what's going on in the brain, but you do have to pick the right person.
Helen Fisher, I've got a great idea. My next date for this single guy is a date to the CT scanner, just me and her. That's what we're going to do. We're going to go together. Helen Fisher, biological anthropologist and professor at the Center for Human Evolutionary Studies at Rutgers University. Thank you.
Thank you.
So is it really just all those chemicals in your brain that led you to the one true love of your life? You've been telling us the very romantic and bittersweet ways you fell in love, whether it was a lightning bolt or a slow burn.
This is Christina Wexel calling from Sarasota, Florida. I fell in love with my husband almost from first sight. It was unique love. We went to high school with each other and didn't know each other then. We met up again later, fell in love, and have two amazing children. He's certainly the one for me. Oh, you say you love
me, Joe. Sometimes love lingers as a memory too powerful to let go, even after decades.
This is Michelle. I'm calling from Portland. And I got back together with my unrequited love after 25 years. Actually, more than that, 26. And now we're getting married. But he was the one that lingered in my head forever. I broke his heart when we dated before. And now we found each other again. Reunited, and it feels so good.
Reconnecting after a long time is a theme we're seeing from a lot of you, even reunions that have just happened. One of you wrote to us from Columbus, Georgia, to tell us about reconnecting 2 weeks ago with the one that got away. You say, it's the most beautiful thing in the world. Now we're really good friends as we were 30 years ago. Couldn't ask for better friends. And while some of you reconnected, a lot of you never had to.
This is Doug from Louisville, Kentucky. I met my wife 23 years ago through a video dating service. On the second date, we both knew that we were the one for each other. 7 months later, we were married. I might be a prototype, but
we're both real inside. Tell us how you're keeping your romantic love life alive. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway with your missed connection. You never know, maybe your true love is a fan of the show. This is The Takeaway.
The only thing I want to experience is winning a gold medal.
Sitting on the slopes of potential history.
We hit up to 6G forces.
Well, the one thing you can count on is absolutely nothing.
If you can't race yourself, you can't race anybody else.
An all-out fight to the finish.
There's no such thing as can't.
Pushing it till the end, and he's got another gold medal.
We go back to Sochi now, where team figure skating has helped Russia get out of the basement in terms of the medal count. But in the men's singles competition, one of the world's best, Yevgeny Plyshenko, withdrew yesterday because of an injury to his back. It was a real shocker for the Russians. Meanwhile, Japan's Yuzuru Hanyu scored the highest score on record in the men's short program. Well, definitely the pressure on the body to deliver a performance like that for 4 or 5 minutes is huge. But whether it's a triple sow cow or a quadruple axel, you've got to ask yourself, how do they do that? It's a question we've been asking about the Olympics all week. Eric Goff is our resident Olympics physicist and the voice of our series, How Do They Do That? He's chair of the physics department at Lynchburg College and author of Gold Medal Physics, The Science of Sports.
One of the key components, the famous component, I guess, is angular momentum conservation. And this is a law in physics we use when we talk about the inside of atoms. And it's a law of physics we use when we talk about galaxies, you know, swirling around out in space. And usually it's in the finale, and you'll see a skater getting ready for that big turn. what the skater will do is put arms out as far as possible, and you'll see one leg out really far, and they're putting as much of their mass out from their axis of rotation as far as they can, and they're getting into a little bit of a slow turn, and then to make themselves go really fast, they pull the arms in very tight, they pull the leg in very tight, they get as much mass concentrated in that vertical axis as they can, and then their spin just starts to go up.
Well, let's face it, watching Olympic skating is a lot more like an effortless ballet performance than an exploration of Newtonian mechanics. And that's why we have Sasha Cohen, winner of the 2006 U.S. Figure Skating Championship and 2006 silver medalist at the Torino Olympics, to help us out. Sasha, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks so much for having me on.
You're very welcome, and it's a pleasure to have you. Well, you heard Eric Goff's explanation there. Look, you've been compared to a lot of things in your life. I'm not sure if a spinning galaxy or a merry-go-round is one of them. Maybe you have.
Well, I can really understand, the physics of it when you're stretching yourself out and creating torque, which you then snap and use as momentum to complete a quad or a triple-triple combination. And although I've never thought about it in those terms, when I think about how it felt in my body, that makes a lot of sense.
And I was hoping to get a little bit of insight into how it does feel in your body when you do that. I mean, you know, forget about the Newtonian explanation, but we've all seen when you Olympic figure skaters are spinning and you pull those arms in, and all of a sudden you're spinning so fast that to the naked eye, it seems almost imperceptibly fast. And you wonder, can you think when you're in that moment? Are you, do you actually have thoughts, or is everything rote at that point when you're spinning, you know, four or five times a second?
When you're doing a spin, it's very much about, you know, finding that center. And then with that center, you use, you know, your legs and your arms to create a different amount of torque. And as you pull it in, you can just accelerate and accelerate and continue to gain speed. And you don't spot, which is different than ballet when they spot with every turn. You spin way too fast in skating to do that. And I actually did something for the Weather Channel, and they were counting my RPMs on my spin, and I apparently was spinning faster than a tornado. So our RPMs are incredibly high.
You must remember your routine from 2006 in Torino. I'm sure that you do.
Oh, absolutely. I think I will always remember.
Okay. I'm sure a lot of people do. And tell me what you think is the most difficult element, maybe not so much physically in terms of like your muscles or your ability to jump, but just the most sort of physically difficult to execute in terms of the laws of nature.
I think combinations are very difficult because you don't have an entire setup to prepare. You can't create momentum. You have to really take whatever you have left from the first jump, balance and counter the torque you have coming out, stop it, rotate it the other way in order to create enough momentum to get up again. So I think combinations and triple-triple combinations were definitely the most challenging part of the sport.
You mentioned the men really quickly, and I wanted to ask you about sort of injury and limits. We've all seen that Yevgeny Plyshenko has decided to not continue in these Olympics. We've learned in the last day or two here a back injury that's forced him out of the competition. Russians were shocked, of course. He's one of the world greats. And it makes me sort of wonder about the limits of your body when injury comes into play. Every athlete, every world-class athlete fights through pain, fights through injury. But as you see Plyshenko bow out, what does that sort of tell you about the limits of your ability to do what you do when there's an injury on hand?
Well, we all push our body as being an Olympic athlete, but there's really a limit. And when you've hit your fourth Olympic Games, you've kind of on your ninth cat life, if you will. So, we deal with injuries. We're taking cortisone injections. You know, we're going through immense pain in order to do what we do and push through an event. But the body can only do that for so long. And it's been, you know, 2.5 decades of Plyshenko pushing through that. And at some point, the body does cave.
Well, if you're watching the figure skating at the Olympics in Sochi this week, maybe you'll have a little bit more insight into the physical acumen that it takes to conquer some of the laws of nature for these figure skaters. And we're so glad to have Sasha Cohen, winner of the 2006 U.S. Figure Skating Championship and the silver medal in Torino in 2006, here to help us sort out some of the science. Sasha, thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
My funny Valentine. Well, from the physics of Olympic skating to the physical pull of love on this Valentine's Day, we're asking for your love stories. Here's one from Zeke in Florida. I think it was 1973. It was at Wind Cave National Park Campground, and she was a taller, older, curly-haired redhead who was very outgoing and extroverted. I was too young to be thinking much into the future, and now I can't even remember her name, but I remember being the first time ever that I had an indescribable feeling in my heart that I realized much later was love. Where she is, wherever she is, much love to her. Well, that's a really old misconnection. It'd be nice if you could find her again, Zeke. Maybe she's listening.
Hi, this is David calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. I met my love in 1986 when we were both 18 in a parking lot at an NXS concert. Over 20 years, we stayed in touch occasionally, ended up divorced and reconnecting, and have spent the last 4 years finding out what it truly means to be connected and in love with someone and loved by someone.
You can give us a call with your misconnections at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work.
Also, dude, Chinaman is not the preferred nomenclature. Asian American, please.
Actually, it's pronounced Milwaukee, which is Algonquin for the good land.
Check out the big grain on bread.
Fridays, as always, movie day here on The Takeaway, and our movie team is here. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, along with Kristen Meinzer, who's culture producer here at The Takeaway, and the other co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Hi, guys.
Hey, Todd.
So we've got two movies on deck today. One is schlocky and very Valentine-y. Let's first go to one that's decidedly not, because I might need a chaser here to cleanse my palate after all the love talk here on The Takeaway today. It's RoboCop. It's a remake. It's 1987. Let's go to a clip.
Walter Carroll, look at me. You have two options. Option one, I shoot you with 50,000 volts, which may cause respiratory failure, organ malfunction, internal burns, and loss of bowel and bladder control. And then I arrest you. Option two, you tell me where John Biggs' drug lab is located. And then I arrest you. You have 2 seconds to decide.
You have 2 seconds to comply, it used to be. Wow, sounds romantic, Rafer.
Very romantic. I don't know if you were a fan of the original RoboCop, Todd.
I was.
As was I. Brilliant film. This one, not so much. This is sort of I found a more serious, more emotional, kind of darker RoboCop, maybe a little bit for the Batman crowd in a way. But I don't really think that works. I don't really think that's what you want from RoboCop. I think you want action, blood, and humor, and there's not enough of any of that stuff in this movie.
But Kristen, this one has Gary Oldman, and you're a Gary Oldman fan.
Yes, I am. I love Gary Oldman, and it also has Samuel L. Jackson, who I love. But unfortunately, this movie just does not have much energy is the problem. It really falls flat. I didn't feel excitement. I just felt like there was a lot of buildup and no delivery. And frankly, I think in RoboCop, you want more violence than in this movie. And I also think you want more tongue-in-cheek moments. That little clip we just heard makes it sound like there's some tongue-in-cheek in it, but there's almost no tongue-in-cheek in this movie.
Well, the last thing you need on Valentine's weekend is a lot of buildup and no delivery, especially from your movies. I'll say that. Let's move on to Endless Love. This is sort of a remake Friday, right? Because
this is
a remake as well. This is 1981, Franco Zeffirelli. I remember this film, and I remember being too young to like it because Brooke Shields was in it, which I think I remember getting dragged to it, I think, by a babysitter. But this one stars Alex Pettyfer and Gabriella Wilde. Here's a clip.
Thank God you're here.
Hey. These are for you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. You have a beautiful house.
Amazing, isn't it?
What are you doing here, David?
Well, Jane invited me.
I'm sorry, but inviting David was never part of the plan.
Endless Love sounds, Kristen Meinzer, like it might be smothered in molasses.
It's smothered in a father who's so overbearing that you can't help but wonder if maybe he loves his daughter a little too much. And maybe the endless love is actually between the father and daughter. And she's just trying to have a relationship with a boy for the first time, her first boyfriend. And the movie, you see the constant fighting between the overbearing father and the kids who are just nice kids in love. That's the whole movie. It's pretty schlocky. I think, though, that a lot of teenagers are going to love this movie.
Rafer?
I will say it actually works better than the 1981 film with Brooke Shields. It's a little more realistic. You kind of understand what the characters are up to a little more. I think my one objection is it has absolutely nothing to do with the book or the film. It is a completely different story. The characters have been totally overhauled. It's like a gut renovation, and they just kept the title on the front door that says Endless Love. But it is kind of an okay teen romance.
Okay, an okay teen romance on Remake Friday. That's Endless Love, a remake of the 1981 film. Of course, we had RoboCop, a remake of the 1987 film. Before we let you go, Kristen, the Movie Date podcast, what do you guys have on tap this week?
In addition to these movies, we're going to look at Winter's Tale and at the remake of
About Last Night.
So it's all remakes, and then we're going to be helping a listener who needs advice on Valentine's Day movies that aren't schlocky.
Valentine's movies that aren't schlocky, important. Kristen Meinzer, Rafer Guzman, our Movie Date team. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
We want to go to one other movie now that caught our attention. There's a new documentary called Being Ginger. It's been making stops around the country. And it looks at the stereotypes associated with having red hair as a woman or as a man.
Redheaded women are more fiery and tempered, I think. In the bedroom, they're very much more experimental and frisky and naughty and dangerous.
What do you think the stereotypes are of redheaded men?
Of redheaded men? Fat. A bit broody. On TV and in movies, I guess.
Are there any redheaded?
Yeah, Ron Weasley. Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But he's a good guy.
He's also a stereotype. He's a loser.
The documentary does raise the question, why is the redheaded man treated so differently from the redheaded woman? Scott Harris is the director of this new documentary called Being Ginger. He's also a redheaded man, and I've also been speaking with Anne Margaret Daniel. She's professor and blogger for the Huffington Post, who specializes in the social history of redheads.
Stereotypically, the redheaded woman is sultry, hot, tempting, wicked, but also compelling. Redheaded men are clown figures. They are weak, funny. Sometimes they're also evil, particularly in literature and in artistic representation. But redheaded women are really the ones who have it going on historically.
There must have been times throughout the ages when people believed that redheaded women and redheaded men, but especially the women, I gather, harbored either some kind of evil spirits or easier access to them.
Absolutely true. In both Egyptian culture and in early Roman days, redheaded women were often regarded as witches. I think representations of the Celtic or Celtic redhead also, where you had larger-than-life actual figures like Queen Boadicea, who gave the Romans a really hard time when they tried to conquer England and happened to be a very tall redhead, added to this stereotype. One that particularly blew me away when I first saw it in the late 1990s on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel was Michelangelo's representation of Eve before and after the temptation. The serpent handing Eve the apple from the tree has bright orange hair, and he's handing it to an Eve with kind of mousy brown hair. But as soon as she's taken the apple, as soon as she's fallen, her hair is the same color as the serpent's.
Scott Harris, you're hearing all of this, and does it sort of strike a chord with you? I mean, you grew up being ginger. It made you make a film.
Growing up in the U.S., my memories from school were that people would tease me a little bit about it. I got bullied apart from the red hair, and I always blamed that bullying experience on my hair because that's what made me different. And that's a big part of what the film is. I wanted to make a film about bullying more than anything else, I think. But it was moving to Scotland and seeing the way that the Scots treat redheads, that these little things happen that were quite funny. And I found a way to take a serious subject like bullying, but wrap it in a more humorous story that I hoped would be more approachable by an audience.
And Margaret Daniel, what are your thoughts as you hear Scott Harris describing his experience in his film?
I have to say, I'm taken with the difference of experience that men I've talked to have had in England, in Scotland, in Ireland, as opposed to the experience that they've had in other places in the world. What's called gingerism in England, for instance, is a lot more intense and a lot more wrapped up in traditional negative stereotypes of men than it is in the United States. So I actually think it's worse there. I don't mean to be cut cutting America a break, really, on this by implying that gingerism is more acute in England and Scotland, perhaps in Ireland. But in America, certainly, little boys particularly get bullied because redheads are clown figures. You know, we've got Ronald McDonald and Bozo the Clown and characters like Sideshow Bob on The Simpsons. So it certainly is prevalent here as well.
And now we're all going down the list in our heads of redheads across the spectrum who we might think of a little more positively. Well, Anne Margaret Daniels, a writer and professor in New York and a blogger for the Huffington Post. And Scott Harris, director of Being Ginger, a new documentary about growing up redheaded in America and maybe a bit in Scotland as well. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
A redheaded stranger from Blue Rock, Montana, rode into town one day. Under his knees was a raging black stallion. Walking behind was a baby.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry today. Well, news today that just last night, a federal judge in Virginia has struck down the Commonwealth's ban on same-sex marriage, called it unconstitutional. According to Judge Arenda Wright Allen, state laws, quote, deny plaintiffs their right to due process and equal protection guaranteed under the 14th Amendment. This latest twist comes just weeks after Virginia's new Democratic leadership said it would not defend the ban in federal lawsuits. State Attorney General Mark Herring saying it was time to be on the right side of history. Of course, Virginia is not the first state to have its gay marriage ban struck down by a judge. Recent rulings in Utah and Oklahoma are similar, and those cases likely headed to the Supreme Court. Now, in Kansas, the legislature there, they see history, or at least their place in it, much differently. They're moving ahead with a bill allowing individuals and businesses to cite their religious beliefs to deny providing services or goods to gay couples getting married or entering a civil union. That bill passed in the Kansas House and is now moving to the Senate. And even though gay marriage is banned in Kansas, that bill would also bar anti-discrimination lawsuits, making the law largely about safeguarding those who want to express what lawmakers have called religious liberty. Well, joining us now to weigh in is Kansas State Representative Barbara Beaulieu, one of 19 Republican House members to vote against the bill. Hi, Representative.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by Alan Rostron, Professor of Constitutional Law at University of Missouri in Kansas City. Hi, Professor.
Hello.
Representative, let me start with you. This pretentious religious liberty protection, I suppose I'll call it, in Kansas is headed to the Senate. You voted against it as a Republican. Why?
It's discriminatory, period, and there's no place for this law. We already have enough laws protecting people to not choose to have business relations with other people, and this was very pointedly at gay people, and it did not fit into what people in my district would support.
Now, your state of Kansas, of course, is very conservative, and famously so. It's at the center of debates on education about evolution and creationism and gay marriage and a lot of other things. Do you anticipate that your state Senate will go ahead and approve this new law?
No. Last night, Senator Susan Wagle, who's the president of the Senate, announced that she felt that this bill would not pass in the Senate, so probably wouldn't be heard. That does not mean it's dead. It could come back in conference committee later in the year and be used as a bargaining chip. So until the session's finished, it's available to be used.
And could come back. Representative, before we let you go, your colleagues in your Republican conference, and I assume there are many of them who are conservatives who think this is a good idea, you've broken ranks with them. What are their arguments aside from just religiosity that this is a good idea for Kansas? They want to stand out?
I don't know, other than they think they're protecting religious people somehow. I also think they like to lead the way on issues such as this. They're also afraid of a federal ruling that potentially could come down this year and challenge our own law. So they want to bolster it, shall I say.
All right. That's Kansas State Representative Barbara Beaulieu. Representative, thank you.
Thank you.
Alan Rostron, Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. There are a couple of issues at stake here, and I mentioned at the top how many of the state marriage bans are getting struck down. But this seems to be sort of a different issue. This religious liberty issue reminds me of like the Hobby Lobby case that's against Obamacare and the contraception mandates. That's a religious liberty issue, and that's in front of the Supreme Court right now.
That's right. And I think there really is an interesting parallel between the two cases. They really are sort of raising the same essential issue, which is that when you give rights to people, which is generally regarded as a good thing to do, of course, it does to some extent infringe on what other people can do. So if you give, you know, more access to contraceptives to people, for example, you might have some employers like Hobby Lobby who feel that that infringes their freedom to make their own decisions about what their religion requires them to do. And likewise here, to the extent that you expand access to marriage and you achieve more equality with that, you know, I think that's certainly a good thing to do. But there's a concern on the other side that, well, does that then start to infringe on the freedom of someone who might not approve of such a marriage and might not want to participate in supporting it in any way?
The Supreme Court is due to hear that Hobby Lobby case at the end of March. And what's at stake there is the contraception mandate that says employers have to provide insurance coverage, and contraception is one of the parts of that insurance coverage. And the company Hobby Lobby, it's a hobby store, doesn't want to have to pay for that coverage. And the court's going to decide. And I wonder if they were to decide against Hobby Lobby and say, no, your religious freedom is trumped by federal law here, would that have a direct impact in Kansas, or are they kind of separate tracks?
Probably separate tracks. You know, the Hobby Lobby case is really about the interpretation of this particular federal statute. This law in Kansas is probably not going to raise that directly. It wouldn't be, for example, the federal government that would be imposing any obligations on people here. It would be a matter more of Kansas law and about whether, you know, private individuals or even government officials. This law in Kansas that was proposed, this bill, would even give government officials like a county clerk the option to decline to fulfill their duty for a same-sex couple as they would for a another couple. So
at the same time, after the recent court rulings on gay marriage, both Don't Ask, Don't Tell and upholding California's gay marriage law, there was a lot of commentary saying, well, there's going to be a tide now. State after state after state is going to come up against sort of a national tide saying they can't ignore rights that have been granted in other states, and that it's kind of a matter of time before we get to sort of a normalized national norm on gay marriage. And that made me wonder if the Kansas state legislature doesn't know that. And even though gay marriage is legally a separate issue, they're kind of trying to set an example and push back against that.
Yeah, I think they are. I think to some extent the law is a gesture. Just like in Missouri, frankly, we had a whole measure passed here in Missouri that said, essentially, we won't participate at all in Obamacare. And it was meaningless. It was legally meaningless. A state can't just declare that they're not going to, that they're going to oppose a federal law. But it was a gesture of opposition, and I think that's essentially what this is. As I think, as you said, the tide is very strongly in favor of the expansion of same-sex marriage. The Supreme Court didn't take the entire step in the decisions that they made recently. They sort of let an opportunity for some time to pass for it to percolate on a state by state basis. But they made pretty clear which way they are ultimately heading when they decide to address this issue again.
What sometimes happens after rulings like that is individual states might try to pick a fight and see if they can get their issue to the Supreme Court. That's Alan Rostron, professor of constitutional law at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. Thank you so much.
Sure.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, and we're telling your stories of love on this Valentine's Day, stories of coming together, remembering that one that got away, and about you lucky and smart ones that have found a way to hold on to that love through all the ups and downs.
Hi, my name is Donald. I'm calling from Martinez, California. I married my high school sweetheart, moved away when I was 17, found her via the internet 26 years later. Neither one of us ever married. I've been married 10 years, best day of my life. Finding her again and marrying her.
10 years and counting. Way to go, Donald.
I met my husband through my brother, and they were in a band together for years, and we very quickly became friends. 4 years later, I went to a wine tasting. He was also there, and we started drinking a little bit too heavily. And thanks to some liquid courage, I was able to tell him about my like. And he also liked back. And our like quickly turned to love. And 4 years later, I am happily married to my best friend.
Well, thank you for that, Katie. You know, we noticed a similar story to Donald and Katie's recently in the Making It Last column at our partner, the New York Times. And on Valentine's Day, we thought, what better way to celebrate relationships than to hear from the expert who've made that love last? That's why we called on Jack Connolly and Bob Gaither. Now, they've been together for 37 years, which means that when they got together, it was in the late 70s, they weren't only defying the odds as a gay couple, but also as an interracial couple. But despite all that, they've managed to stay together, and they were nice enough to share their story with us. Here's Jack on how they met.
We met each other kind of suddenly. We met in a bar, and he was the best. Oh, I hate saying this. He was the He was the best looking guy in the bar. I had been drinking, and we really just hit it off. And after we were together a very short time, we decided we would stay together for 3 years, no matter what. We'd see so many of our friends, you know, after a few months it was over, and we didn't want that. At least I didn't want that.
True. Exactly. It was uncommon.
So that early commitment between you, that not even talking about 10 or 15 or 35 years, but we'll stay together for three, that was really some glue for you.
Yeah. Yeah. If we said 5 years, we would have never made it.
Bob, I read about your story in the Making It Last column in the New York Times. You were featured there. Yes. And one thinks when you're reading that, all right, they stayed together and that's great. But boy, what a low percentage play. You guys met in a singles bar drinking. One of you was staying at the YMCA, which was a bit of a crazy scene, as it's described, with a lot of carrying on and sex going on.
Yes.
Not really the kind of meetup that you would think would lead two guys to stay together for the rest of their lives.
My background is military, and I had to, you know, be pretty quiet in the military and been going through a little stress, things like that. I was just looking for somebody to, you know, just to spend the rest of my life with, someone to stay with and make my life complete.
Jack, Bob, sounds like his experience in Vietnam really led him toward a commitment. And you guys are obviously of the same generation. I wonder if the war years affected you in any way in that sense, or even later on, the AIDS crisis, whether it sort of provided stability for the two of you to want to stay together more.
I think, Todd, it was the AIDS crisis. We kept seeing our friends dying, and I cannot tell you how many funerals we went to, and it made everything else pale in comparison. We volunteered, you had to, with AIDS support groups, and it was, we just felt helpless. You couldn't do anything. And that kind of gives you perspective that other things aren't so important. And when we were growing up, they had laws against gay people. And gay kids, LGBT kids growing up today, are quote-unquote normal.
Exactly.
And they can have relationships, you know, that are as open as anybody else. They can get support that we couldn't get. So, you know, we were forced together with the AIDS crisis, and kids today have got a whole network that we never had, and it's just wonderful seeing that.
Well, Jack and Bob, I've done an awful lot of sort of praising your relationship, and you deserve it. 37 years, no doubt about it. I got to bring this back down to earth a little bit. I don't know if it's the cynic in me or the realist. Jack, tell me, what do you guys fight about? I have to know. Come on.
I'll let Bob answer that.
Bob, you want to take a crack at it?
Well, I mean, what you might do, Todd, is just destroy an otherwise happy relationship. But go at it.
Fight about not a lot. I mean, I'm pretty organized, a clean freak, you know, and it's like an evolution. You know, you always pick it up for somebody else. And earlier on, he would like come home, throw a pair of pants on the bed and leave it there. I'd say, you're going to hang those up? and then the other thing is like the big fight was his cooking. That night he cooked that 7-course meal and asked me the question that how I liked it, and I said, well, food is food.
Ooh. Ouch.
He almost was picking the china out of his hair that night. This is a person that was having nothing but military food, and he had something that wasn't out of a can, and he didn't notice it. That's changed.
Well, he's the cook. And, I mean, I've cooked nothing. I mean, in the 30s, I think I tried to cook like some chicken dish, which I totally messed up. And so we figured that, you know, you got the kitchen, I got the rest of the house. So I'm the clean freak, and he does all the cooking.
Well, all right, we got all the bad stuff out of the way. But it is Valentine's Day, and you all have been together for 37 years. But I wonder if you have any notions of getting married, you two crazy kids, after all this time. Or does it not matter?
Yes, I want to get married. Yes. Do you have anyone in mind?
Just leave me the cat.
Well, Jack Connolly and Bob Gaither, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And happy Valentine's Day to you both.
Same to you.
Well, sure, it takes a lot of hard work to keep those relationships going. All this hour, we've been hearing your stories about the one that got away. And man, that love is still strong for some of you. Here's Mary from Queens, New York. The one that got away, I met Seb at my gym. He was intelligent, confident, caring, and just so interesting and very much a bad boy with a notorious past. I fell for him. He said he was interested, but we never got together. He moved away from New York City. It's been 6 years, and I often think of him and what could have been. Well, Mary, Seb, are you listening? Seb, Mary's still out there in Queens, New York. Well, Mary, here's a little inspiration for you.
This is Pam from Jacksonville. It's the question of, are you with the one or is the one still out there? I think the person you choose is your one, and that you have to work hard to make your one consistently and constantly your one, loving unconditionally and growing with each other.
Here's one listener from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who says, we were kids, we played in the woods, rode bikes, flirted, except we didn't know what that was. I was 14. He turned 16, drove his car around my block hoping to see me. I watched out of my bedroom window, too young and too shy. But he filled pages in my diary. Fast forward 40 years, crazy internet. There he was, same smile, same twinkle, in the same brown eyes. I sent a note. He replied, and we fell in love all over again. And this host is choked up. Whether it was the one that got away or the one you managed to hold on to, or the one you're eyeing from afar, we want to hear about it on the show. Of course, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to share your story, but don't choke up the host. That's the key. And if you want to catch up on that conversation, you can always check us out at thetakeaway.org. On that note, we hope everyone listening has a great Valentine's Day. Thanks for making the host cry a little bit with your stories of romantic love. Thanks for listening. Todd Zwillick in for the very stoic John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews, now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.